Hey, Republican convention and your guests. That was certainly some welcome. And I am most grateful to you for it. It'll be a matter of long remembrance to me. This is the fifth time that I have had the high honor of addressing the convention of the Republican Party. But from the inexorable course of nature, this is likely to be the last time that I shall attend your convention. In each of those four-year intervals, I have pointed out the inch-by-inch destruction of the ramparts of free men in the United States. That is the issue before this convention, this election, and this party. That issue can be expressed in one phrase, the freedom of men. And that today includes our relations with the rest of the world. That issue transcends in importance all the transitory questions of natural life. That is a matter of life itself. Throughout the centuries of history, freedom has been the constant quest of men. For this, the best and the bravest on earth have fought and died. The tablets of free men, lost in the dark ages, were again handed down to the American people. Those tablets have been not only the words of the Declaration and the Constitution, but they express the very spirit of free men. Do you not believe that the words and the spirit have been distorted and violated? Yes! I might examine the record for you just a minute. The genius of our founding fathers was the inlet which preserved this republic longer than any republic, was the concept of the limitation of powers within the government. One of their strong purposes was to protect free men by restriction of presidential power. For 20 years, we have seen the constant attrition of those constitutional safeguards of free men. I don't need to recall to you the rubber stamp Congress, the packed Supreme Court, war without the approval of Congress, and a score of dire secret international commitments without the consent of the Senate. And now comes, after 170 years, a new discovery in presidential power. That is, of course, the inherent power to seize anything at any time. Inform you that all Republican presidents were densely ignorant of that inherent power business. Over these 20 years, we have seen pressure groups fostered and appeased by presidents until they intimidate and paralyze the life of this nation. No man or no group of men have been elected by the people to have such power. If freedom is to live, we can no more have economic tyranny than we can have political tyranny. Representative government has not been maintained today as the master in our house. Our social order does not rest upon constitutional safeguards alone. This republic was founded on a pledge of sacred honor, yet we have writhed under shocking disclosures of intellectual dishonesty and unpunished corruption in high places, greater in aggregate than all the sins in our history put together. The grandeur of a people comes from their moral and spiritual character. Today, that grandeur is corroded by this intellectual dishonesty and corruption among public officials. The drip, drip, drip from dishonor in high places plays a part in the increasing crime amongst our people. These acts do not make for free men. There have been other assassins of freedom also. In only 8 years since victory, we will have seen tax and tax and spend reach a fantastic total greater than all of the previous 170 years of our republic. Now this plush curtain of tax and spend, behind it, there are three sinister spooks or ghosts. They're mixing a poison for the American people. They are the shades of Mussolini with his bureaucratic fascism, of Karl Marx and his socialism, and of Lord Keynes with his perpetual government spending and deficits and inflation. And now we have added a new ideology of our own. That is government giveaway programs. In a few minutes, I will measure for you the blight of inflation that this mixture has poured into every American home. But by way of the bureaucracy part of this mixture, within 20 years, we have seen it grow from under 600,000 federal officials under Republican administrations to over 2,300,000 today. And with the addition of 1,000 new government agencies. So in fascist fashion, they dictate and give orders and favors to our citizens. Still worse, bureaucracy has a real inherent power. Their inherent power is that of all bureaucracy to lay their paralyzing hand more and more heavily upon free men. They rush headlong into their fantasies of the millennium, and they send the bills to the treasury. Now, if you want to see pure fascism mixed with a giveaway program, you just take a look into the Brannon plant. If you want to see pure socialism mixed with a giveaway program, take a look at socialized medicine and socialized electrical power. Those things do not make for free men. Man was created somewhat lower than the angels, but to him the Creator gave the right to plan his own life, to dare his own adventure, to earn his own reward, so long as he does no harm to his fellows. Either we shall have a society based upon ordered liberty and the creative energy of free men, or we will have a dictated society. There are immutable principles which neither the rigors of depression nor the tricks of inherent power nor lost statesmanship nor wars nor new dealers nor militarists can change. Those immutable principles came into the universe along with the shooting stars of which worlds are made. And they have always been and ever will be true. Such are the presence of God, the laws of gravitation, and the ceaseless struggle of mankind to be free. Shall we keep that faith? Must we condemn unborn generations to fight again and to die for the right to be free? Nearly 40 years ago, I have had to deal with our international relations. I would be less than frank in this, my hoped-for last address to you, if I did not speak from my heart and from that hard experience. And I can relieve all candidates of embarrassment by stating on their behalf at once that all of these views, are a monopoly of my own. And if I seem to stress our foreign policies, I do so because within them lies the future of freedom in America, and because in the First World War, I witnessed the communists give rebirth to slavery on this earth. One Democratic and three Republican presidents refused to recognize their government and thus admit their official agents into our households. Over those years, I have known a long roll of good men and women in many foreign lands with whom I worked in intimacy to save their starving peoples, who died in communist dungeons or dangled at the end of a hangman's rope. So for years, I have protested the lost statesmanship of having any dealings with them. That is what has dragged the world into these calamities. However, there is no satisfaction in having been proved right by disasters to the American people. Now, until 20 years ago, our dedication to free men was admired and aspired to by all mankind. The undertakings of our government were trusted throughout the whole earth. Today, that respect and trust have been blemished by 100 actions. 12 years ago, we were led into a great war crusade on the promise of freedom to men and to nations under the banner of the Four Freedoms and the Atlantic Charter. Then at Tehran and at Yalta and Potsdam, we sacrificed the freedom of 600 millions of human beings on the altar of appeasement to communism. The souls of one quarter of mankind have been seared by the violation of that American promise. The ghosts of the Four Freedoms and the Atlantic Charter now wander amid the clanking chains of 1,000 slave camps. But where have we arrived at after this crusade for freedom? I need not remind you that we lost the peace despite the valor and the sacrifice of our manhood on 100 battlefields. Our bewildered statesmanship has brought no return from the sacrifices and the tears of millions of mothers and wives. There is less freedom in the world today than at any time for a whole century. Do you believe that our foreign policies over those years have been a success? Our opponents frequently remind me that this is all in the past. The past is the father of right now. Now we have to deal with the menace that they create. It was nurtured by policies participated in by our government, by communists in the highest echelons of our Washington administration. Until now, the Kremlin cracks its whip over a horde of 800 million people. They are now armed with 300 divisions, 30,000 tanks, 20,000 airplanes. American and British traitors have given them the atomic bomb. Therefore, our need right now is a cold and objective look at where we have got to, both abroad and within the United States, under the Truman-Acheson foreign military and foreign policies. Now, time tonight only permits me to appraise where we've got to on three major fronts. That is Korea, the Western Europe, and the United States. I might have a little constructive suggestion to make toward the end. Now, this situation in Korea was born of Yeltsin. It was nourished by American support to the so-called agrarian liberals in China. We joined with more than a 20 of non-communist members of the United Nations to try and defeat this communist aggression. But today we find ourselves punishing 90% of the military forces sent there and taking 90% of the losses. America's price, as you've been often told, already is 120,000 dead, wounded, and sick. With 300,000 more of our youth still fighting. General MacArthur Wells said that in war, there is no substitute for victory. This administration substituted appeasement on the 38th parallel just where we started from. Now, after 12 months of negotiation on that appeasement question, the communists so far do not seem to want to be appeased. In the meantime, they've so increased their forces that the military initiative is now in their hands. The end is not yet. But can anyone say that these policies in Korea have been a great success? Now we also may take a look at the second major area of the Truman-Acheson policies. That is Western Europe. Beginning 6 years ago with an unrepayable loan to the Britain of over $3 billion, the administration has poured $35 billion into Europe. They have been trying to build up the willpower of those people, their military strength, to furnish them with American ground arms. For 6 years, we have listened to a multitude of plans, agreements, pronouncements, promises of great European armies. And I will examine for you for just a minute what the result has been from this effort. 3 years ago, with the signing of the North Atlantic Pact, we were again told that the great ground armies would at last spring into being on the continent. And to pass that treaty, a pledge was given to the Senate by the administration that we would not contribute more American ground troops to Europe. Then we shipped them 200,000 more American boys. 3 years after this North Atlantic Pact, In February of this year, there was another conference at Lisbon. It was impressively announced that by the end of this year, 1952, exclusive of American and British divisions, an army of about 15 battle-worthy and 25 reserve divisions would be built up in Europe by the end of the year. The London Times, commenting on this Lisbon pronouncement, published an editorial entitled A Phantom Army. The Times pointed out that even this small army could not possibly be ready in 1952. 6 weeks ago, we witnessed the signing of a step towards freedom of Western Germany. That was a good deed. A few years later, a few days later, we saw the signing of the European Defense Community Treaty by six continental nations. That will be an advance in European unity, provided it is ratified by their six distracted parliaments. But it was announced in the New York Times of May 28th that by a secret agreement, these six nations would by 1954 or 1955 create 55 divisions, of which 15 would be reserve divisions. I dislike to trouble you with statistics, but this problem has got to be understood. Aside from the American and British divisions, this European army seems determined to keep its phantom quality. Can anyone say that this sized army, even within 3 years, is any real deterrent in a ground war against the already six times greater forces of the communist horde? Or that it could even avert a Dunkirk of the six American divisions that we have placed there? Compare this promised 50-odd division army 3 years hence with the 160 effective divisions. These same six Western European nations, comprising as they do 160 million people, put into the field within 60 days in both World War I and World War II. Today, their manpower and their productive capacity is greater than either of those wars. The potential is there, but we must now realize that the willpower is lacking. The only other explanation of their attitude is that these six nations of Western Europe have no stirring belief in any present danger. We have heard no clamor from these countries to spend their lives and their fortunes or their sacred honor to defend their liberties. They have proclaimed no such emergency, carried on no such propaganda of peril, nor stimulated no such war of psychosis as have been constantly poured out from Washington, D.C. Can anyone honestly say that this making of great ground armies in Western Europe has been a great success? Now let's take a cold look at the economic and social effect of these administration policies on the United States. Some of us are interested in that place, too. It is no news to you that the federal and local governments are spending about 35% of the national income. That is more than any nation can bear. I have long had great sympathy for the humble decimal point. He has to jump three zeros every little while. He had to make three jumps to punctuate our present deficit. Now, we don't have to look very far to find the blazing proof in our midst that we cannot carry this economic burden. If you think these policies are not producing an inflation which is wrecking American lives, I would like to recall a few things to you. Already, after this 6 years of these Washington policies, the American worker must have an annual income of $4,500 today to live as well as he did on $3,000 a year 6 years ago. If this don't convince you, look about you at the necessary round of wage increases going on today, which means you can buy less with your money tomorrow. And look around, and you will see millions who have earned pensions or saved to protect their old age being reduced to the tragedy of want. And look further, and you'll find not only inflation, but that the intolerable taxes stifle initiative and are driving millions of our people to become more and more dependent upon the government. And look again, and you'll find this tax and spend used as a vehicle to mix collectivism into American life. You can look even more deeply. No government can spend such sums of money and not corrupt the spenders. No government can levy such taxes without breeding a horde of tax dodgers and bribers. Do you want to go on with this spending and inflation and corruption? If free men are to survive in America, we must reduce spending and taxes. That is an axiom. It is true, we can make some cuts in spending by stopping waste and corruption and private privilege. But the total of all such reductions would not even reduce the budget deficit, the prospective budget deficit, by one half. To say nothing of stopping inflation or reducing taxes. It is not enough just to say that we will balance the budget and reduce taxes, or to say we'll do it some years hence. We have to face the grim reality of how and where to do it now. The reality is that we cannot ever balance the budget and reduce taxes except by cutting into this military and foreign spending. To find this how and where and still do our part in the world, we ought to take a new look into these military policies. The administration and the Pentagon have been building up four gigantic military programs. First, they insist on huge ground armies. Second, naval forces. Third, air forces. Fourth, subsidies and munitions to other nations. And now they propose to add huge numbers to these armies by compulsory universal military service. All of this, step-by-step building of great ground armies is the road to militarism in the United States. That is at its base the threat to all freedom. That has brought ruin to freedom ever since Rome. That wrecked Germany and Japan. Moreover, the military strength of America does not lie today in great ground armies. How many mistakes do we have to make before we learn that our genius lies in the invention and production and operation of great weapons? Our future is in these great weapons, not in bayonets. And we can furnish these great weapons to nations who have a will to defend themselves. Now, lest you think the Pentagon is not determined on bayonets, I may mention their bulletin of February 1st of this year, which I quote. They say, the individual rifleman is the most effective and most essential weapon against the enemy. All other services exist to support the infantry soldier. Now, all Americans wish to see the civilization preserved in Western Europe. But we must recognize their lack of will and preparedness, which might have been a deterrent to communist aggression. And therefore, we must determine for ourselves what real deterrent Americans can furnish within our economic and manpower capacity. The effective deterrent which American resources can contribute is not bayonets against overwhelming...